At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Crime with Holly. I'm your host, Holly, and today I have another solved murder case for you all. But before we dive in, I just want to say thank you to everyone for the amazing feedback that I have received on last week's episode about Jordan DeMay and the dangers of financial sextortion. I have had many of you reach out telling me that you have now had those conversations and discussed things with your preteen and teens, and I just want to say thank you. These are conversations that absolutely need to be had, and keeping that conversation going and keeping an open communication with your kids is so incredibly important. Remind your kids that no matter what, you will be there to help them through anything. Just yesterday, I had the conversation again with my oldest son, who is 13, and I kind of had like a more watered down conversation with my other son about online safety. And he is just 9, so he doesn't quite understand that, you know, other things are out there than just stranger danger. But having these conversations can and will save lives. So if you know a parent, even if they don't really like listening to podcasts or if they don't like listening to true crime, just recommend that episode because I think it's very eye-opening that this is a problem in our country. I made a TikTok video about it this last week, and I had several moms comment on there that this exact thing happened to their sons as well. And thankfully, their sons were brave enough to come tell their moms that something bad had happened, and it didn't end in tragedy as well. Other than that, I don't have any other case updates for you guys. And I just want to remind everybody to please join my private Facebook group at Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group. You can just put that in your search engine on Facebook and you should be able to find it. I love being in there with you guys and having the opportunity to chat. So get in there, post all things true crime, and let's discuss different cases. And don't forget that if you want to sign up for my Patreon, it is just $2 a month. That gets you ad-free episodes. You don't have to listen to those pesky ads. So you can visit the link in the description or go to www.patreon.com/crimewithholly. Okay, so without further ado, let's get into today's episode. Today's episode is on the murder of 15-year-old Annie Kasperzak. Annie Grace Kasperzak was born on January 10th, 1997, and unfortunately, her story started very rough. She was born into a family of dysfunction and was ultimately taken from her birth parents and placed into the Utah foster care system. I don't really know the full details about her birth parents other than they were abusive, and it was just not a situation and not a life that any child should ever have to live. And while in the foster system, things for Annie didn't get easier. She went through multiple foster homes, and it sounds like every time she was beginning to settle in, she was given back to the state and placed into a new home. This happened a total of 9 times for Annie until finally her caseworker named Veronica Kasperzak decided that enough was enough and she was going to adopt Annie with her then husband Dennis. Both Dennis and Veronica were in their early 20s, but they were ready to embrace parenthood. In January 2007, 10-year-old Annie finally had a family to call her own and officially became a Kasperzak. By this point, Veronica and her husband had two young boys, so she became a good big sister. She absolutely adored her little brothers. Annie was described as being very kind and nurturing to her little brothers, and she really stepped into that big sister role and took it very seriously. Now, I just want to pause and really say that Veronica is an amazing human. Not only is her job as a social worker an emotionally draining and very difficult job, but she seems to have a heart of gold. And in an episode of Dateline that I watched on this case, Veronica talks about how her own mom always tells her that she can't save every single child, but she really tries her hardest to do so. And it really is proof with Annie. Veronica saw this broken down little girl who had been through so much and only just wanted a family to love her. And Veronica stepped in to do that. And even though Veronica and her husband Dennis provided Annie with stability and care and a loving home, Annie still struggled. She had been through so much, and she often pushed boundaries to see if she could find the straw that would break the camel's back, pretty much. Time after time after time, she was given back to the state. And when she finally was given this loving home, she often had this fear in the back of her mind that it wasn't going to be forever and that she was going to do something that would end up sending her right back to the state's custody. So instead of living in constant fear that something was just going to happen, she kind of pushed those boundaries to see if she could make it fall apart quicker. But Veronica and Dennis were in this for the long haul, and they just loved her through her emotional struggles and tried to do everything that they could to show her that this love is for real and it's going to last. They wanted her to know that we love you, we want you, and we will not give up on you. And that's just so sad, and honestly, it's the reality for so many children in the foster care system. They live in fear that they're not going to be enough and will be given back to the state. It just crushes my soul to think about that. But again, Veronica was amazing. And given that she was around children like this for her job, she knew exactly what to expect. And so she was very patient with Annie. And she just tried to show her how loved and worthy she truly was. 3 years after the adoption was finalized, Veronica and her husband, Dennis, made the tough decision and decided to get a divorce. But they co-parented Annie and her two younger brothers well, and this split seemed very amicable, and Dennis and Veronica, from my understanding, remained friends. But of course, this was very tough on Annie. This little family that she came into and loved was being torn apart. That meant yet another move for Annie, which was a hard adjustment. Not only was she moving again, but she also had to switch schools, which meant that she was going to be leaving behind the friends that she had made. So as you can imagine, for a girl who had been through so much, this was a very tough adjustment. But again, Veronica and Dennis were very patient with her and they co-parented well. Eventually, Veronica would date and then marry a man by the name of James, and he also adored Annie. James and Annie really bonded, and life seemed to be going pretty dang well. Annie had James wrapped around her finger, and James said that Annie could just literally talk him into anything that she wanted. If there was something that she saw at the store that she wanted to buy, all she had to do was turn to James and ask him, and he would pretty much cave almost immediately. On Valentine's Day 2012, Annie spotted a pair of red shoes, and red was her absolute favorite color, and she fell in love with these shoes. She turned to James, and naturally, he bought them for her. He was just this really big softy when it came to Annie. In 2012, Annie was a freshman at Summit Academy in Draper, Utah, and she took her education pretty seriously. She had big hopes and dreams of becoming a therapist. She just wanted to help children that were like her and had been through so much, and that is why she picked to become a therapist. Not only that, but Annie also begged James and Veronica to adopt more children. Veronica talked about how Annie would encourage her to adopt all these different kids that would come through her office. She just wanted all of the kids to feel the love that she finally felt from Veronica, Dennis, and James. So by this time, Annie is a freshman, she's a teenager, and she's beginning to want a boyfriend and to find that connection that will stay around and last forever. She was the type of girl that would be all in for those she cared about. Veronica said in an interview that Annie was extremely boy crazy, which is normal for a lot of teenage girls. But for Annie, every single boy she became interested in, she was all in. She became hyper-focused on that person. She was in love with them immediately and couldn't imagine life without them. And I think this really stems from all that she had been through. Annie wanted that unconditional love. Though she had it from her adoptive parents and her stepfather and even her little brothers, she seemed to still long for more, which is understandable given her tough life. The older she became, the more apparent it was that Annie wanted to start her own family. Annie wanted to be a mom. Even though she was just 15 years old, she started fantasizing about having a baby, and she even wrote about it in her journal. She wanted a baby so bad. And it's because she wanted that connection that could never be taken from her. Because biologically, this baby would be half her. She longed for that biological connection that, unfortunately, Veronica, Dennis, and James couldn't give to her no matter how hard they tried. Saturday, March 10th, 2012 started off as any other Saturday. That evening, Annie babysat her younger siblings while her mother and stepfather went out on a date night. When Veronica and James got back home, everything seemed fine. Veronica noticed that Annie had changed out of the shorts that she had been wearing around the house earlier in the day and had changed into jeans. This didn't seem that unusual. She just assumed that Annie had gotten cold and put on some pants. Veronica had a super bad headache that she couldn't shake, so after getting home, she went up to her bedroom to take a shower, and Annie went downstairs to her room to listen to music. But when Veronica got out of the shower, Annie was gone.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Late on March 10th, 2012, Veronica and her husband James found that their daughter, 15-year-old Annie Kasperzak, was missing. Found under a blanket on her bed was a handwritten note from Annie that read, quote, "I'm sorry, Mom, I made a mistake. I lied to you about a couple of things and I'm sorry, but I have to leave. It's not you, it's me. By the time you read this note, I'll be on my way to California. I lied to my friends. I told them I was P, but I only wanted their sympathy. That's why I lied. I feel out of place here, and my only way out is to run away. Please don't try and look for me because I don't want to be found. I love you guys, but I have to go." End quote. Now, that P that she said that she lied to her friends about, the P stood for pregnant. So Annie was claiming that she told her friends that she was pregnant. Just a few months before Annie ran away, Veronica learned that Annie had been sexually active. Annie, being 15, thought that now that she had had sex, she could possibly be pregnant. She took a pregnancy test, which ended up being negative, and Veronica got her on birth control. But for whatever reason, Annie decided to lie to her friends, telling them that she was pregnant anyway. Obviously, after reading this note, Annie's parents were devastated and immediately called the police to report her as a runaway. They also started calling some of Annie's friends, including Annie's on-again, off-again boyfriend named Darwin Christopher Bagshaw, but he went by his middle name Christopher or Chris. Chris was 14 years old and had been in this on-and-off relationship with Annie for about a year and a half, and Annie was obsessed with him. She thought that this was it. He was the one, and she was just so infatuated with him. When Veronica spoke with Chris, he said that Annie wasn't with him, but he did speak to her earlier in the night. According to Chris, he said that Annie talked about running away with some guy named LJ. This was a new name for Veronica. She had never heard of a LJ, and apparently Chris really didn't know much about him either. After talking to Chris, police arrived to collect information about Annie, and it was during this time that Veronica had the idea to see if maybe they could track Annie's phone. It wasn't exactly specified how they were able to track Annie's phone, but I'm going to assume it was because they had some sort of Find My iPhone and was able to see her location. To their surprise, Annie wasn't far away at all. She was near the Jordan River Parkway Trail, which is a scenic trail that people often run on or they take their horses down there to ride. And at night, it's a popular makeout spot for teens. They saw Annie's movement, and at first it was going pretty slowly, like she was walking. Then all of a sudden the speed picked up like she had gotten into a car or something before it completely disappeared. Police went out to go search for her, and by this point it was 10 p.m., it was dark outside, and Veronica didn't want to just keep sitting around at home waiting, so she also went to go look for Annie. She went to a local Walmart near where the signal last pinged, and she went inside if the door greeters or any cashiers had seen her daughter, which they had not. After driving around a little bit and still no sign of Annie, she went home to wait for her, expecting her to walk through the door. And during this time, they repeatedly called her phone, and all calls went straight to voicemail. Now, in their minds, they're assuming that Annie will just come back. She had never been gone more than an hour from home. She had never been one to run away. This was very unlike her. And for them, the worst case scenario that could potentially play out would be that she would come home and she would be pregnant. But unfortunately, what they were preparing for mentally as the worst case scenario was far from it. The following day, on March 11th, 2012, 911 dispatchers got a call from a jogger that had been out running the Jordan River Parkway Trail. And I have that call and I'm going to play it for you guys.
911, what is the address of the emergency?
You know, I'm not real sure. I'm at the river bottom and there's some pools of blood. And I'm guessing it's just an animal, but in the water right by the river, there's a shoe.
Police responded to the scene and forensics were called out to do a presumptive test to determine whether the blood was animal or human. And it was indeed human blood. This led the authorities to believe that it was a possibility that there could be a body in the river because the location of this pool of blood was literally right along the river. Ground searches were conducted and highway patrol sent a helicopter up to start searching along the riverbanks, and within less than an hour, they found something. A mile north of where this jogger found the pool of blood, the helicopter found a body floating in the river caught up in some branches. The body was a female that had been wearing a red and white plaid shirt, blue jeans, and had a red shoe that matched the other shoe found near the pool of blood. Divers went in to recover the body, and they found that she had been badly, badly beaten. Her face was so incredibly swollen, and the injuries to her face were extensive. She had been so badly beaten that her nose was completely gone, and her lips were busted open. Autopsy would later confirm that she died from blunt force injuries to the head, including but not limited to skull fractures, and that the manner of death was homicide. It was also believed at first that this was a female in her early 20s and that this woman was an Asian woman. Media quickly picked up that a body had been recovered from the Jordan River, and Annie's parents saw it and they didn't think that it could be her. Annie at this point had only been missing for 20 hours. She obviously was not an Asian woman and she wasn't in her 20s. So they thought that there was just no way it was her. Not long after the reports about a body being found, more details of the victim was given during a press conference done by police in an attempt to identify her. They reported that the victim had been wearing a red shoe. During the press conference, they showed pictures of the shoe, and that is when panic started to set in for Annie's family. The shoes were the exact same red shoes that her stepfather James had just purchased her a few weeks before for Valentine's Day. They tried to remain calm and think that maybe this was just a crazy coincidence, and they called the police to tell them that their 15-year-old daughter was still missing and that she wore those exact same shoes. However, they told them, you know, she's not Asian, she's not in her 20s, and Veronica was very hopeful that the police were just going to rule out Annie as being their Jane Doe, but they couldn't rule her out. Veronica said that when they couldn't rule her out, she just had this gut feeling that this was her, and she started sobbing uncontrollably. She just knew deep in her heart that it had to be her daughter and that she was gone. Because Annie was beaten so badly that she was unrecognizable, she was identified by a scar that she had from having her gallbladder out, as well as her braces and the dimple, her distinct dimple in her chin. Of course, positive identification also happened through DNA. Now that Annie's family was able to identify her and investigators knew who this Jane Doe was, it was time to buckle down and figure out who could do this to a 15-year-old girl. They started with the typical questioning of her parents and friends trying to gather any and all information. And they did a search of Annie's bedroom and collected her diary to see if that held any kind of clues. In her diary, Annie often wrote about her boyfriend Chris and their on-again, off-again relationship. She also wrote about wanting to become pregnant, about how badly she wanted a baby, and about how she dreamed of starting her own little family. Annie also wrote about being pregnant with Chris's baby earlier in the month of March. And I don't know if this was before Annie took the pregnancy test and that she thought she was pregnant. I don't know if this was maybe like wishful thinking that she was doing or if she was trying to lie to herself and believe her own lie. But when autopsies are conducted, they check for that as well. And it was confirmed that Annie was not pregnant. So while investigators were collecting things from her room and statements from friends and her parents, this is when authorities learned that Veronica and James had spoken to Annie's boyfriend, Chris, right after they found that she was missing. And Chris told them that she said that she was going to run away with a boy named LJ. On March 14th, investigators went to interview Chris, and this isn't necessarily because of what Veronica told them about this LJ person. They, of course, wanted that information as well, but Chris was one of the closest people to Annie, so naturally they had to speak to him. When Chris was being questioned, because he was a minor, his father, Darwin, was present as well. Chris told the authorities that he and Annie had sex only once before she was murdered, and it had happened just a week before her death. He mentioned the rumors that were circulating that Annie was pregnant, and that he believed that the baby had to have been LJ's. Chris says that Annie had been going around bragging for a while that she was pregnant with this LJ's baby, and that LJ was some 17-year-old dude that she had been sleeping with. When asked about this LJ guy, Chris said he knew nothing. He said that he had never met or seen him, and he had only ever spoken to him once on the phone. Chris says that he doesn't know what he looks like, he doesn't know where he lives, he doesn't know what he drives. He literally knew nothing other than this dude's name was LJ. He couldn't even tell police what LJ stood for. Was it just a nickname, or was that legitimately his real name? When asked about the last time that he had seen Annie, Chris said that he hadn't seen her for a few days before the murder, but he did speak to her on the phone that night. When asked about where he was on Saturday night, Chris said that he was over at his grandmother's house all night long. He said that he did leave for a short period of time to walk over to a friend's house to see if they could hang out, but that friend wasn't home, so he went back to his grandma's. Both Chris's dad, Darwin, and his grandmother confirmed his story that he was there at her house all night long, so he had a pretty tight alibi. They also asked him to give a DNA sample just in case, and also asked for him to give over his clothing and shoes that he had been wearing on that night. Again, just kind of a routine thing that they have to do. Chris willingly cooperated, and he handed over all the things, but he did warn the police that there was probably some of Annie's blood on his shoe. He said that the last time that he had seen her in person and they were hanging out, she had a nosebleed that got on his shoe. He couldn't remember which shoe it was. He said it might have been only on the shoelaces, but he said that she for sure got a nosebleed while sitting next to him at their friend Spencer's house. And he just wanted them to be aware because if they test it, there's likely a little bit of her blood on there. Now, obviously, for me, at least, my true crime brain is going off. It seemed like a little bit of a fast explanation to say, like, oh my gosh, hey, just so you know, she had a nosebleed and it got on my shoe. I have to say, I've never had any of my friends' nosebleeds get on my shoes, but what do I know? It seemed kind of weird to me, but given his airtight alibi over at grandma's, grandma saw him, dad saw him, it didn't really seem that crazy. It didn't seem like he was involved. Police went over to speak to Spencer just to confirm this nosebleed story and collect any information from him that he could give. And he also confirmed the story. She had a nosebleed, it got on his shoes, yada, yada, yada. When they asked him about LJ, Spencer also knew nothing. This LJ guy didn't seem to be known by anyone, but everyone seemed to know of him, which is kind of weird. And that was a difficult hurdle for the authorities to jump over. They needed to track down and figure out who the heck this dude was. Spencer, Chris, and many of Annie's friends all spoke of this LJ being a bad boy type of guy and said that Annie had even said that he was in a gang. And according to Spencer, he even told the authorities that Annie had said that LJ had killed someone before. And she was scared that LJ was going to kill Chris because allegedly he had made threats before. And all signs are pointing to this LJ character, whoever the heck he is. While they were trying to figure that out, on March 15th, authorities received a phone call from Chris's dad saying that LJ had driven past their house and was making threats towards his son, Chris. So this became like a dire situation that they needed to figure out who this was before he hurt somebody else. Police went back to Annie's home to do another sweep of her bedroom, and this time they uncovered a handwritten poem that Annie wrote, and at the top of it, she wrote, "To LJ, Leighton Jenden." They finally had a full name, But despite that, they still could not track this guy down. There was no Leighton Jendon in any records or databases or anything that they could uncover. So he was still this massive mystery. Detectives held yet another press conference trying to encourage anyone to come forward with information. They were looking for witnesses to the crime, people who may have heard through the grapevine what had happened, and they even named LJ in this press conference. They said that they were looking for people who knew of someone who went by LJ. And it was because of this press conference that a woman named Joanna Franklin came forward with information. Now, I will say that this Joanna was not an outstanding citizen herself. She had been picked up on fraud charges, but she said that she knew LJ. And given that this LJ, from what we have heard, wasn't the best dude either, this jived. This seemed legit, like they knew each other. Joanna described LJ as a 19-year-old young man who was short and he was Hispanic, but she said that he looked like he was white. Joanna also dropped a bombshell that she was present, she was there, on the night that Annie was murdered. Joanna told police that she was willing to give them all of the details and tell them everything she knew about LJ and the murder and what had happened. But she wanted something in return. Joanna wanted immunity on these fraud charges that she was now facing. And the police were so eager to solve this murder and get justice for not only Annie, but for her family, so they agreed. Joanna tells the police that she had seen a young girl at the home of Daniel Ferry. Apparently, this wasn't the first time that she had seen this girl at the house, but she later learned that it was Annie. Now, Daniel Ferry was very known to police. He was a known drug dealer, he had a rap sheet that was a mile long, and he was known to be extremely violent, and lo and behold, he was also a gang member. According to Joanna, while she was at Daniel's house, Annie showed up with this LJ guy. And I guess at some point, Annie and LJ disappeared into the garage. Joanna claimed that she assumed that they were out there having sex, and when they came back inside, she saw Daniel Ferry approach the girl. Daniel asked Annie if she wanted to have sex, and she laughed at him and said no. And this enraged Daniel. He got so mad. He felt so angry and embarrassed and all of the things. So he grabs Annie by the head and slammed her face and head into the wall as hard as he could, knocking her unconscious. When Daniel slammed Annie's head into the wall, blood sprayed all over the place and got all over the walls and the carpet. Joanna said that Daniel was so worked up and pissed off that everyone tried to calm him down, including LJ, but it wasn't working. She said that LJ, Daniel, and another person named V carried Annie, who was still breathing, out to the garage and changed her clothes. When asked what they changed her into, she couldn't give a super clear description other than that she was wearing a lot of red. A red and white flannel shirt and red and white shoes, which this description matched the description of what Annie had been wearing when she was found. So all of this seems like an extremely promising lead, especially if he slammed her head into the wall and we know that she had severe damages to her head and face. Joanna continues to tell the police that after changing her clothing, LJ, Daniel, and this V person wrapped the unconscious Annie in a blue tarp and put her into a white Suburban before they took off. When they came back hours later, Daniel was covered in blood. Joanna asked him where the girl was, and all Daniel said back was, quote, "She went swimming and she put up one hell of a fight when we got there," end quote. After getting Joanna's statement, police went out to start interviewing more people about Daniel and to see if they had heard anything about this murder. And everyone that they spoke to that knew Daniel, other than Joanna herself, said that there was no way that Daniel would be involved in this. Sure, he was not the greatest dude, and he had been violent in the past, but Daniel would never harm a teenage girl. Police were granted a search warrant of Daniel Ferry's home, and they found some pretty interesting things. When they arrived to his home, they found that not only had the carpets been recently ripped up, but the walls had also been freshly painted. And given the timing in all of this, that seemed super suspicious. They were, however, able to find traces of red stuff on the walls in several areas, and they took swabs of that for testing. After searching his home, they found Daniel at a nearby apartment, and they arrested him and brought him in for questioning. Daniel willingly agrees to talk to them without a lawyer, and he seemed genuinely shocked that they were there questioning him, and he was telling them that he had zero idea why he was there. They started off by asking him about LJ, and he was like, "Who's LJ?" And the investigator told him, "Well, you know, that's why we're asking you. Who is he?" And Daniel responded with, "Dude, I don't know no LJ." So the investigators were like, "Okay, well, then tell me about Annie." And again, Daniel was like, "Annie who? Who is Annie? I don't know this person you're talking about." And they told him that Annie was the girl that was over at his house for the party last weekend. And Daniel just kept saying he had no idea who they were talking about, and he asked them to show him a picture. So they show him a picture of Annie, and he asks, "Well, is her name Brittany?" And the interrogators are kind of like fed up at this point. They're like, "This guy is just full of crap. He's not telling the truth. We're not buying who is Annie, who is LJ. Like, this guy just needs to be honest." So they straight up tell him, like, "Listen, this girl in this picture, her name is Annie, and she's dead." And Daniel looks completely confused, and he just says, "Okay, well, I didn't do it. You guys think I did, and now I want a lawyer." At this point, as we all know, investigators have to stop asking questions, and instead, they went ahead and charged Daniel with Annie's murder. Everything seemed to be pointing to him. Between Joanna's story, the condition of his apartment with the carpet missing, and what appeared to be blood that they were waiting for forensics confirmation that it belonged to Annie, and the fact that Daniel was this gang member, and they learned that his nicknames that he often went by were Joker, and then another nickname was Little Joe, which could be shortened to LJ. All signs, again, were pointing at Daniel until the forensics came back that that red stain, those little red stains that they found in multiple places on the walls, it wasn't Annie's blood. And in fact, it wasn't blood at all. Despite that, they still felt confident that Daniel Ferry was their guy. The charge for Annie's murder had to be temporarily dropped, but thankfully he wasn't going to get out of jail because he was now being investigated for a separate crime. And that crime was for a kidnapping and assault charge in a neighboring town. So this gave the authorities more time to continue to build their case against Daniel Ferry. Months would go by and they were still trying to piece everything together, but the pieces weren't falling into place. The lead detective, Derek Johnson, was promoted to sergeant, which meant that the case was now being handed over to one of his good friends, Detective Jacqueline Moore. And she did what any good detective would do. She started from the beginning combing through everything to see what led them to Daniel Ferry to begin with. Detective Moore was hoping to find some of those missing links for this case so they can finally charge Daniel Ferry once again with Annie's murder. She wanted to see if she could find links from Daniel's phone and his location to Annie and this case, but what she found instead was shocking. She found that Daniel wasn't even in the area when Annie was murdered. Instead, he was in the middle or northern part of Salt Lake County, and where Annie was killed and where she lived was in the southern part of Salt Lake County. He had been nowhere near where Annie was killed or her house at any point that night. And in the months after he was first arrested, Daniel did plead guilty and was sent to prison for that kidnapping and assault that I mentioned earlier. And come to find out, that kidnapping happened on the night that Annie was murdered, on March 10th, 2012. So there was no way that Daniel Ferry could have been involved in this murder. It has since come out that Joanna Franklin had been lying all along about witnessing Daniel assault a girl in his home. Instead, it seems like she used this opportunity to get back at Daniel because apparently Daniel used to sell her heroin and he eventually cut her off, which made her angry. Joanna also admitted that she made the story up to get out of those charges she was facing for fraud. She later testified in court saying, quote, "I tweaked the story to be what he wanted to hear. Like I lied to him. I don't even know all the stories I told, but they weren't true," end quote. And so, in March 2013, a year after Annie's murder, Daniel Ferry was officially ruled out. This entire thing with Joanna really pisses me off because she had authorities wasting so much time on this story. It was a dang wild goose chase that they wasted precious time and resources on. I honestly don't know whatever happened to her, but I feel like charges should have been filed for making false statements. But again, I don't know if that ever happened, but if it didn't, it should have. With this new revelation, detectives were back to square one. Detective Moore spent months poring over everything, including Annie's journal entries, to get a better understanding of who she was and what was happening in her life. It was very, 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 very apparent how much Annie loved Chris and how badly she wanted to be loved and valued in return. Annie was a very sad and broken girl from everything she went through in her life. The only thing in life that truly mattered to her was finding love and creating a family. She wrote about having sex with Chris, and the further Detective Moore dug, it seemed like potentially Annie had faked this pregnancy to keep Chris around. While Annie knew she wasn't pregnant, she was telling everyone she was. Did Annie tell Chris she was pregnant and he did something to her? Detective Moore then turned to the phone records and she found that on the night of March 10th, before Annie ran away, not only was Chris the last person she spoke to on the phone, but their call log was very interesting. The calls were 30 seconds here, 2 minutes there, and every single time the call ended, the other one would call back immediately. Sometimes the calls were ignored and sent to voicemail. Sometimes Chris would block his number when calling her. But what became very apparent was that this looked like a fight. Like they were calling each other back and forth, sometimes answering, sometimes not. They would talk for a little bit, then they would hang up out of anger. It was clear that the two were fighting. This, of course, raised red flags. Chris never mentioned a fight or an argument between the two when being interviewed in the past. Detective Moore also went to visit with one of Annie's friends named Jackson, and she just wanted to go over things with him, and he mentioned that Annie often talked about someone named LJ. Now, Jackson had the wits about him to ask Annie at some point, like, okay, who is this LJ guy? And Annie told him his real name. His name was Chris. Talk about stars aligning here. It would later come out that Annie referred to Chris as LJ. And I don't know why that is. He doesn't have an L or a J in his name. That Leighton Jendon that she had wrote before, that was never linked to him in any kind of way. They never found out anybody named Leighton Jendon. I don't know if maybe that was a baby name or something that they had talked about before, and so she called him LJ. I really don't know, but this is very crazy, and it came as a massive surprise that lo and behold, this LJ was Chris. And it was Chris who initially told Annie's parents and police that she ran off with LJ. This Jackson kid was the first person that knew Annie that detectives could find that knew LJ's legit name. And it blows my mind that this wasn't uncovered sooner. Sadly, while Detective Moore was working through everything, the original detective on this case, Detective Derek Johnson, was killed in the line of duty. Derek Johnson pulled over to what he thought was a stranded motorist, and when he got out to assist the person, they shot him. Unfortunately, he didn't pull through, and he left behind his wife and young son. Not only was this a tragic loss for the entire Draper PD, but Detective Moore was very close with him, and the two had been working together during Derek's free time on this case. Derek took with him a lot of knowledge that he had on this case, and that left Detective Moore feeling utterly broken and almost lost. Not only did she lose her friend, but she lost a key person that held a ton of knowledge on her big case that she was now working on. And let me just say that this was, I believe, her very first big homicide case. She vowed to get justice for Annie and to give closure to her parents, but to also honor her friend Derek Johnson. She wanted to solve this case now more than ever. And even though Christopher Bagshaw had what seemed like an airtight alibi, she wasn't sure she was buying everything he fed to the authorities originally. While looking through his phone records, she noticed that not only had Chris talked to Annie that night on the phone, but his grandma had tried to call him several times around midnight, and then Chris called her back at 12:30 p.m. Now, if you remember, the original story that he told was that he was at his grandma's house all night long and had only briefly left earlier in the night to see if his friend could hang out, but his friend wasn't home, so he went back to grandma's, and grandma and dad backed up the story that he was there all night. And if that's the case, why would grandma be calling Chris and him calling her back if they were in the same house? That just didn't make sense. Another thing that stood out to Detective Moore was the story about the nosebleed that Annie had. She listened back over his interviews, and originally Chris said that there would only be one drop of blood on his shoe. In a second interview, he said that there would be two drops of blood. But when the tests came back from the shoes, they found more than just two drops of blood. There was a large amount of various different drops in different areas. Also, to Detective Moore's surprise, she found that the soles or the bottoms of the shoes had never been tested, which that's also crazy to me as well. So Detective Moore, she sent the shoes off to be tested yet again, and they found that the bottoms of the shoes had been completely coated in blood at one time, like he had been standing in pools of blood. When DNA testing was done from the bottoms of the shoes, they couldn't get a solid profile, but they were able to determine that there was female DNA present on the bottoms as well as two males. Detective Moore knows that Chris's friend Spencer backed up this nosebleed story, so she went back through his statements and interviews. She learned that while he was being interviewed, Spencer had been on his phone texting the entire time. It got so annoying to police that they actually asked him for his phone and they went through it. And this is when they found an interesting text message that Chris sent to Spencer, and it read, quote, "The cops might come to your house. I need you to tell them that Annie got a bloody nose because she did, but you were laying down and she got some on my shoe. They took my shoes for testing, and I need you to tell them that so I don't get blamed. I just want you to know I'm not telling you to lie to the cops. I just know that you were kind of dozing off that night." End quote. And this is, again, I keep saying all of this is crazy to me because I don't feel like, I hate to criticize, but I don't feel like the investigation really was thoroughly done. I feel like they had all these pieces, but they didn't really fully look at everything because they were so sidetracked with LJ and figuring out who he was, and then Daniel Ferry, but I'll talk about that a little bit later. But it's crazy to me that the authorities investigating this didn't look into this further. They didn't press this harder. They have a kid here saying, hey, this is what happened. Hey, don't forget, you know, you were dozing off. Go ahead and tell this to the police. I think this whole LJ story from Joanna just really had the authorities with this one-track mind that this teenage boy, he couldn't have done it because there's this mysterious LJ guy, and they were only focused on that. So Detective Moore, she spoke to Spencer, and he admitted pretty much that he lied for Chris. He did remember hearing about the nosebleed, but didn't actually witness it for himself. With all of this new information in hand from the friend Jackson saying LJ was Chris, the shoes having more blood on them than they ever knew, and this nosebleed story being a lie, this was still not enough to arrest Chris. Detective Moore was so committed to solving this case that she actually signs herself up to take a course on cell phone mapping. The instructor for that course was a former homicide detective named Cy Ray, and he agreed to help Detective Moore with her case. Cy Ray and his team combed through over 35,000 calls and text messages from Chris, and one singular incoming phone call cracked this case wide open.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
At 9:01 p.m. on March 10th, 2012, Annie Kasperzak's boyfriend received a call that would help solve her murder 2 years later. Annie's mother, Veronica, was the one to call Chris looking for her daughter. She had just found the note left behind in Annie's bedroom, and so she called Chris immediately. Because just that morning, Annie had told her mother that Chris had asked her, quote, what would you do if I asked you to run away with me, end quote. And when Annie told Veronica this, Veronica told her that if she ever were to run away, Chris would be the first person she would call. And it was that phone call at 9:01 p.m. to Chris that solved this murder. And I'm going to try and describe this the best that I can. It is a little bit confusing. But when Veronica called Chris, his signal bounced off of four separate cell phone towers 25 times. It bounced from tower to tower to tower to tower, like boom, 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 boom. And they refer to this signal bouncing as a handoff. So essentially, the signal is so similar and a poor signal at that within these four different towers. And so it's being thrown or bounced to tower to tower trying to get like the best signal. Detective Moore and Cy Ray worked together and found the only spot between those four cell phone towers that it pinged off of that would create this weird pattern of cell phone pings. And it was at the Jordan River, exactly where Annie had been murdered. On October 14th, 2014, Detective Moore traveled to Grand Junction, Colorado, where Chris was now living with his mom. While on his way to school, two undercover officers approached Chris and brought him in for questioning. He refused to talk and answer any kind of questions, and he asked for a lawyer. And Detective Moore tells him, that's fine, we'll get you a lawyer, but we have a warrant for your arrest for the murder of Annie Kasperzak and obstruction of justice. And all Chris replied with was, quote, I thought I had proven myself innocent, end quote. Well, Chris, you didn't. You skated by for over 2 years. You were lucky there, but you did not prove yourself innocent because you are not innocent. Chris was extradited back to Utah, and once he was there, he refused to speak to police and he pled not guilty. His trial was scheduled to take place in late February 2016. While awaiting trial, Chris was placed in juvenile detention because he was still just 17 years old. And while there, he told his roommate all about the murder of Annie, and that roommate went and ratted him out. Chris told him that Annie had told everyone that she was pregnant with his baby, and he told her to meet him down by the river so that they could run away together and start a new life. Chris had brought a shovel because he was going to try to bury her, but for whatever reason, he couldn't dig a hole. And I'm going to assume that it was because the ground was still frozen. When Annie arrived, he repeatedly struck her in the face with the shovel while she screamed, pleaded, and told him that she loved him. Chris then stuck the point of the spade to her forehead while she was still breathing and stomped down on it, killing her. When this information was compared to the autopsy, the injuries were consistent with this exact story. And what a tragic, brutal, and violent way that he murdered Annie. All because she loved him and she said that she was pregnant. It's just disgusting to think about, but what's absolutely insane to me is that Chris was just 14 years old when he murdered Annie. That is a year older than my oldest son, and I could not imagine him being so violent and so angry. A few weeks before the trial, Detective Jacqueline Moore was surprised to get a phone call that Chris's attorney scheduled a random hearing. And that hearing was to change his plea from not guilty to guilty. Chris had a change of heart. They didn't offer him a plea deal. He just had a change of heart and he wanted to take responsibility for what he had done. And I am so thankful that he did. This meant that Annie's family did not have to sit through all of those gruesome details about how he repeatedly struck her with a shovel, all while she pleaded for him to stop. During his sentencing, Chris did give a statement where he apologized to Annie's family and his own family for what he had put everyone through. Whether he's truly sorry or not, I don't know. But if I were to guess, I would say that he's not really sorry, but he's more sorry that he got caught. He had over 2 years to come clean, and in all of those years, he never acted remorseful or cared about the pain that he caused. And actually, if anything, he pretended that he was this mourning and heartbroken boyfriend. This kid even posted on Facebook after her body was found, encouraging everyone to wear red the following day in honor of Annie and to show how much they all care. He wrote, quote, "The world is filled with hate, and no one understands the pain of losing someone they care about until it's too late and they're already gone. It's sad what happened to Annie, and I don't know why anyone could do this to someone like her. She was awesome, and we all loved her very much. Even though we had times we disliked each other, we always made up and reevaluated our friendship. She was the best," end quote. And again, this dude wrote that, this long-winded post, the day his dirty work was found. He's sitting there writing this as he could likely still smell her blood, still hear the sound of the shovel repeatedly hitting her in the face. He's just disgusting, if you ask me. Again, he's more sorry that he got caught, and unfortunately, his sentence was way too light. Chris was sentenced to 15 years to life in prison and will be eligible for parole in 2034. And I hope to hell every single time he goes up for parole, he is denied over and over again. He does not deserve to ever step foot outside of prison walls. I don't care how young he was when he committed this crime, the anger, the force, and the pure evil it takes to repeatedly strike someone in the face, the way that he did is just disgusting. I do not believe he should ever be released. You guys, you will have to let me know your thoughts and opinions on that. I do know that he was underage. He was just 14 years old. Do you think children should be allowed to be let out on parole? This case is a tad frustrating for me, though. You guys heard me go on my little off-script tangent earlier. But the fact that Chris was not looked into further from the get-go, I know he threw them off by mentioning this LJ and then other people having heard this LJ name before but didn't know who it was, which of course it secretly ended up being Chris. And I know it also doesn't help that his dad and grandma covered for him and said that he was at his grandma's house all night. If you want my opinion, I think they should have also been charged with some sort of obstruction of justice or something because they clearly lied. But even if someone has a solid alibi or seems like they have a solid alibi, I feel like they should have just gone through the motions anyways to clear him completely. And had they done that, this would have been solved so much sooner because they would have seen the stuff from the cell phones. Either way, major kudos to Detective Moore for never giving up and to fighting to find answers for this case as soon as the case was handed over for her. All right, guys, that is all the information that I have for this week's episode. Make sure you join my private Facebook group by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group. In there, I share all information and pictures pertaining to the cases that I cover, and I also encourage all members to share all things true crime. Find me over on Instagram at CrimeaHolly, and if you would like more true crime content, find me on TikTok at crimewithholly.podcast. Lastly, check the link in the description for my Patreon, and for just $2 a month, you can listen to every single episode ad-free. I will be back next week with another all-new episode. Until next time, be aware and take care. Bye-bye.
Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.